broken, and begun to return. This is one of the connections that broke when he exhausted himself. I was thinking, if I could reinforce it...
She cut him off with a look of wide-eyed horror.
What? You want to splice another spirit inside him?
Oh, apologies, that's not what I meant. I'll graft purified Dream Madra into him and let his own spirit rebuild itself.
It's doing that already.
Yes, but if I let it continue, it will be like he's being born all over again. There's no telling who he'll become. At his core, Dross was a compilation of many minds and spirits that had been pieced together and then developed into an individual over time. But on some level, he was still a memory spirit. Just remembering who he had been might be enough to make him that person again. Or it could start him over from the beginning. Sasha looked completely overwhelmed.
Okay, let's say you can do that. What happens next?
Well, improving the connection in that ring would hook over to this one, which would accelerate its regeneration. That's my biggest concern. If I could make all the repairs at one time, I'd get Dross back as he was, but fixing one link in the chain starts a cascade I can't predict.
Lyndon could tell his mother was only following him on the most theoretical level. He had hoped her years of experience would make up for her faulty education, but then again, this was a unique spirit. Perhaps the only expert in the world was Northstrider. And the monarch had never responded, no matter how many times Lyndon called his name.
So if you were to repair him, you'd either be bringing him back to life or killing him.
That phrasing hurt, so Lyndon focused on the job. Technically, he should be functional now, just without much personality or most of his memories. That's what I'm trying to bring back.
I see,
Sasha said faintly. Then she corrected herself.
No, I don't see it all, but I will.
With determination, she began sketching Dross's internal structure. Her drudge bristled with sensors and flew all around. To his mother, every new mystery was an opportunity to learn. That was something he'd always been proud of. But he had hoped she would know an answer that would help him now. Just waiting to see if Dross recovered went against everything he wanted to do. He wanted Dross back. Lyndon released Dross, letting the purple loops fade back into a ball at the back of his spirit. For now, he needs time. He'll stabilize slowly, which will give him better odds of recovery, I hope. Sasha placed a hand on his shoulder.
I'm sorry. All we can do is our best, and the rest is up to the heavens.
Lyndon clenched Suriel's marble in his hand and nodded.
Not fair,
Yeren said, immediately upon catching sight of Lyndon. Little Blue and Orthos had finished supervising Kelsey's training for the day, and now they were sitting on his shoulders again. You could raise a spirit of your own, Lyndon pointed out. There are sylvan river seeds forming out by the pond.
You ever spent time chatting with the sword spirit? No, because they're always cutting. And blood spirits are...
She shuddered. Lyndon had interacted with some blood aspect remnants, and even their dead matter tended to act as sadistically as possible. Then again, the only real blood spirit he had spent any time with was Ruby, and she was an exception in most ways. Little Blue gave a little chime of sympathy and ran down, leaping off Lyndon's sling and over to Yeren. Yeren caught her, looking pleased.
You are a peach and a half. You don't have to ride him around all the time, you know. You're invited to stick with me.
Little Blue whistled that she was sticking with both of them, and if anything, Yeren looked even more touched than before. Lyndon thought she might cry.
Aren't you a gem? You know how to pick 'em.
Yeren nudged Lyndon's shoulder. When she jostled his arm, she noticed his sling again.
Still can't piece that together.
Lyndon sighed.
The underlying structure of the binding is damaged. No matter how much Hunger Madra I add, I can't fix it.
In fact, the problem was essentially the opposite. He had flooded the arm with Madra of a higher quality than he could handle when he'd consumed energy from the wandering Titan. At this rate, he'd have to replace it, but he was holding back. He needed to find Hunger Madra of a higher quality, and there was only one source for that. Without it, he could potentially get the binding working temporarily, but it would be a patchwork fix at best. Yeren hesitated, stroking Little Blue's hair while she searched for the right words.
Not taking a side myself, understand. But why don't you grow a new arm? Like one with skin?
I don't want to lose the technique. Consuming power is the fastest shortcut I have for advancing.
Most people didn't have the option of regrowing body parts, and they needed a remnant prosthetic. But most people didn't have sages and monarchs who owed them favors. Linden was certain he could get his arm back if he wanted it. But he didn't. The new one was more convenient, and his sense of touch was even returning with time. When he advanced to Herald, he expected it to be just as good as his old arm would have been. Of course, when he advanced to Herald, that would make him a monarch.
You planning on fighting one-handed all the way to monarch?
I could fix it after that, I suppose.
She broke into a crooked grin and leaned into him. Little Blue gave a tinkling laugh.
Just thought hitting monarch wouldn't take long, didn't you?
Linden cleared his throat.
Not exactly.
Can't lie to me. My dream techniques are too powerful.
Well, without consume, I will definitely be slower.
Yeren leaned deeper into him until he wrapped his arm around her.
Wouldn't mind trying that myself for a change. Dragging our feet, seeing the sights.
Linden was reminded of a blood spirit who had been excited to see the world with her own eyes. Ruby. He glanced at the red streak of Yeren's hair and wondered how much of that longing remained. People had been telling Linden to slow down for years, but he had never felt like he could afford to. Now, though. Yeren went on.
Most sacred artists are advancing for something. Keep a home, take over a sect, kill a rival, bake a cake, I don't know. Not saying that's for you and me, but I just thought maybe we could try it for ourselves, since we've got the chance. See through their eyes for a while.
As much as Linden ached to do something, he was beginning to think she might be right. The Dread Gods were loose out there, but they weren't about to kill him, and they weren't his responsibility anyway. He couldn't explore the labyrinth yet, he couldn't fix Dross yet, and he couldn't advance yet. All he had left to do was cycle normally and investigate his sage powers. And just live.
I guess we could try that, Linden admitted.
For a while, at least.
The caravan of cloud ships were not as advanced as those provided by the Akura family to reach the Uncrowned King tournament. They took 3 months to get from the desolate wilds to Serpent's Grave, landing regularly to refuel their constructs from ambient aura and their store of scales. Over the course of that journey, everyone went on with their lives. Naru Huan sparred against Linden more than once, making Linden glad that he wasn't an enemy. He was quite practiced in fighting against Black Flame, possessing several sacred weapons designed explicitly for that purpose, and he himself was a powerful and crafty opponent. Not that he was able to win. Linden himself had more matra than he did, even if he didn't use any sage authority, not to mention his other special advantages. If Dross had been able to give him a combat report, Linden thought he could beat Naru Huan every time, even if he limited himself to only his pure core. Not that he told the Emperor that. Naru Huan spent the rest of his time either dealing with the administration of his territory, visiting his family, or with Aethon. Officially, he was looking for advice on advancing to Archlord, but Linden thought he might just be enjoying the chance to spend time with someone who saw him as a friend and not an emperor. As for the rest of the Naru clan, Captain Naru Gui saw entirely to the leadership of the Skysworn and was never on the same cloudship as Aethon at the same time. Naru Seya, by contrast, had become much friendlier than Linden realized she could be. She trained the other underlords from her empire, sparred with Yeren, sought advancement tips from Aethon, and even challenged Linden to a duel. Once. He thought she was enjoying this trip as a sort of pleasure cruise, and was glad someone was enjoying themselves so much. If anyone else was having as good a time, it was Little Blue. She had grown addicted to training Kelsa, and was now seeking out fights with the other jades and golds on the ship. She mostly used the empty palm, which she could forge to make big enough to interact with a human body, but she could also partially manifest the hollow domain and even accelerate herself with the soul cloak. Her battles with Jai Chen's spirit, Fingerling, were especially entertaining to watch, as she would quickly become tired of using techniques and just wrestle instead. After introducing his tiny form to everyone, Orthos was true to his word and spent most of the trip inside the Dawn Sky Palace stolen from Sephara. Lyndon kept expecting him to get bored, but he insisted that bored was better than elevated. The other person who longed for boredom was Zeal. He kept trying to rest, but wherever he went, the sect of twin stars found him. They always found him. Someone had given Zeal the title Master of the Training Hall, and any students who needed specialized training hunted him down. Zeal tried his best to scare them off, but he was prevented from outright refusing by the oath he'd made to Athan in return for the pure storm baptism. The sect quickly figured out that he didn't mean all the harsh things he said, and that became part of his charm. They sought his advice on everything from scripting, to advancement, to technique training, to roommate squabbles. Every time he was asked to rule on which jade most deserved to eat lunch first, or whether a low gold or new gold sign was really making his snoring worse, Lyndon was certain he'd summon his hammer and knock someone into the horizon. He never did, though, leading Lyndon to wonder if he didn't mind as much as he pretended. Mercy, meanwhile, was perhaps the busiest aboard the fleet. With Fury absent, Charity and Malice were the two remaining pillars of the Akura family, and Mercy had sworn to take on their burden, so she had been taken away by the Heart Sage to help lead their clan. For about a week. Charity brought her back, haggard and worn, with a pile of work that could be completed on the ship. Lyndon was starting to appreciate how much effort and expense went into such spatial travel, even for only one passenger, and was surprised that Charity had allowed it at all. When he saw Mercy's state of living death upon her return, he also wondered why Mercy had returned. Surely she could have visited them once they arrived in Serpent's Grave. But just chatting with him about the day's training, or playing with Little Blue, or dragging Yeren along to visit the other ships, gradually brought her back to life. She was like a plant absorbing life mudra, going from wilted to healthy in an instant. A few weeks later, Charity returned to pick Mercy up one more time, and she took a deep breath before diving back in. This repeated several times, with the Akura clan sapping her will and time with her friends restoring it. Lyndon imagined how pride must feel, seeing the situation from the opposite side, and the thought amused him. The trip to Serpent's Grave was a great improvement to Lyndon's mood generally. Since leaving Sacred Valley, time to relax was scarce. Not that he knew what to do with himself when he wasn't working, as every single person he knew pointed out at every opportunity. But even life with his family had grown easier, which Lyndon suspected had to do with his parents witnessing not only his sacred arts, but the general deference everyone else showed him. Having an emperor ask for pointers during training didn't hurt his reputation. He and his mother practiced soulsmithing, which started as him showing her what he'd learned and ended up with her grilling him constantly for information. With his father, he didn't have much in common, but the restoration of Jaran's eyes had helped his attitude. Lyndon pushing both his parents to advance to jade had helped as well, even repairing the shape of Jaran's long twisted leg. He no longer needed a cane, a fact that seemed to amaze him every day. But he still limped occasionally when he wasn't paying attention. Everything physical had been cured, but after so many years, he had to learn how to walk properly again. Kelsa, meanwhile, had advanced to low gold. Lyndon spent a few weeks nurturing up a white fox remnant he'd taken from Sacred Valley. He had to cleanse it with his own pure madra, then supplement the remnant with white fox madra he'd refined until it met his quality standards. Once he considered the remnant advanced enough for his sister, she had no trouble bonding it whatsoever. Jailong had been very concerned about that, which Lyndon supposed made sense, considering the man's own abnormal advancement to low gold. Lyndon had the materials for another heaven's drop, and some of the refiners on board were skilled enough to help him make one, but Kelsa had a much more difficult time adapting to the control over her gold madra than he had. At first, he had assumed she was suffering from the effects of spending so long in Sacred Valley, or from practicing low-quality cycling techniques for so long. But it turned out this was common, even in those with flawless foundations. Some people just didn't have a good sense for madra control. She would gradually adapt, but it left Lyndon surprised. He had intended to forcibly advance his entire family to the peak of true gold immediately, and had expected Kelsa to break through to the Lord realm without much trouble. He wondered aloud if maybe not everyone could advance as quickly as he did, even given the chance. Yeren had stared at him for 5 straight minutes when she heard him say that, while Ethan laughed himself sick and then stored the memory in a dream tablet to share with others. Linden still didn't see why it was funny. Ethan, as usual, was everywhere. He hopped from ship to ship, keeping an eye on everyone, though he could have done that without moving, and popped up randomly to give advice to every guard, soldier, servant, deckhand, and fighter in the fleet. Linden wondered once again when Ethan found the time to work on his own advancement. But then again, the cloud ships had never been cleaner. Ethan ate dinner with Linden and Yeren almost every night, regaling them with stories from all over the fleet, often including stories that he hadn't been privy to and that the subjects would probably object to sharing. His greatest contribution to the trip was undoubtedly giving Linden and Yeren tips on their advancement. As it turned out, there were reasons beyond the mystical why heralds found it difficult to comprehend sage techniques and vice versa. They required almost entirely opposite training methods. To become stronger as a herald, Yeren had to push herself to the limit and accumulate power. It took a mind-boggling quantity of resources to push one to the peak of herald, which was the way to maximize the chances of a successful advancement to monarch. She had to cycle diligently, take every elixir she could afford, and fight often. Yeren found that an easy road to travel. But to advance as a sage, Linden had to meditate on his icon and take actions to align himself conceptually to its deeper meaning. Linden began to wish he had another icon because aligning himself to the void icon meant long hours of reaching out toward it and trying to empty his thoughts. Yes, it was boring. But Linden found it easier and easier to gather his willpower and exercise his authority, which made the boredom much more bearable. Reaching Archlord, Ethan said, would come to them with time. Advancing to Archlord required insight into their future, which Linden and Yeren had already glimpsed by touching on Sage and Herald respectively. As for how exactly Ethan knew how to train Heralds and Sages to become monarchs, despite spending so many years stuck at Underlord, Linden had asked him almost immediately.
"The sacred arts aren't as reliant on personal experience as people think," Ethan had responded. "There's an underlying structure that can be comprehended if you look at things the right way."
He wouldn't elaborate any further, saying that Linden was already on the right track to see for himself. Honestly, Linden was just happy to have gotten a straight answer out of him. As for Yeren, there had been other times that they had lived together for months at a time. The Black Flame Trials, working for the Skysworn, even not so long ago in Nine Cloud City between rounds of the Uncrowned King Tournament. But in each of those, they had been working together toward one purpose. Now, they were just living. When Linden was younger, learning enough sacred arts to live a normal life had seemed like a distant adventure, ambitious beyond his reach. This ordinary daily life with Yeren gave him a taste of that dream. Linden found that he enjoyed it. When they arrived in Serpent's Grave, the Emperor arranged another elaborate welcoming display on the scale of a citywide festival. During this one, Linden had to make a public appearance. Not only was he an adopted son of the Aurelius family, but he was from this branch of the Aurelius family. From a certain point of view, this was a huge honor to the current patriarch, Guyon Aurelius. Linden had never met the man before, but Guyon was quick enough to bask in reflected glory. Serpent's Grave was a city built from ancient, giant dragon bones. Almost every building was either carved into a towering rib, supported by yellowed fangs, or resting inside a skull. When Linden had last seen the place, it had just weathered an attack from the Jai clan, and he was taken away by the Skysworn. Now, Aurelius family colors were everywhere. Their crescent moon symbol stood out from each street, and their banners flew dark blue, black, and white. Guyon Aurelius was therefore very important here, but Linden didn't care much for the aging True Gold. He had far more respect for Guyon's son, the next heir to the Black Flame branch of the Aurelius family, Cassius Aurelius. Cassius sought out Linden and Yeren after the major welcoming ceremony, his curly hair shining golden. He held a long, thin silver saber at his hip, and he bowed gracefully before the two of them.
"I hoped I would be able to welcome you back someday," he said, "but I never dreamed it would be like this."
Linden was happier to see Cassius than he had expected. Windfall settled over the city. At first, Lyndon intended to stay only long enough to get the refugees from Sacred Valley started in their new lives, but there was always someone who wanted the opinion of the Void Sage, and Cassius was dealing with some rivals who had been sabotaging his operations in neighboring cities. Once Yeren took a casual stroll in the streets of those cities without using a veil, the obstacles to the Aurelius family quietly disappeared. All in all, there was always something else to do. Windfall went from waiting in the sky, ready to depart at a moment's notice, to sitting on the ground inside the city walls. Before long, a camp of the Twin Star sect sprouted around it, and the season slid slowly by. Regan Shen tore through a crowd of slavering ghouls made from Hunger Madra with a sword that blazed like the sun. His body was so weak as to be worthless, and he had lived among the suppression field for months. He was panting and sweaty, caked in filth. But Regan hadn't always been a monarch. He had fought his way up, just like the others, and he had forgotten nothing. The ghouls hungered for his blood essence, for his madra, for his lifeline, for his authority, for his soul fire, for any source of energy he had on him or in him. He gave that energy to them in his attacks, flooding them with power from the edge of his blade, slicing them in half with a weapon of golden sunlight. He left chunks of Hunger Madra dissolving on the ground behind him. Some of the other half-formed spirits stopped to feed on the essence flowing out of their comrades. Regan Shen finally found his way to a stretch of wall. This had once been a door, but centuries ago it had been filled in and sealed off, never intended to be opened again. There was no key to this door any longer, and the wall was almost indestructible, but almost indestructible was no obstacle. Shen deactivated the sword, noting as he did that the red-gold blade was starting to warp under the strain. Using powerful sacred instruments in this environment was terrible, and his heart ached at the waist. There was almost no such thing as a true monarch-level construct. Monarchs died so rarely that weapons formed from their bodies or remnants were considered final life-saving treasures. There might even be more Abaddon artifacts on Cradle than monarch weapons, though no one would be able to prove that. But this sword had been made by a monarch and intended for use by monarchs. It was a work of art, and outside of this maze it could cleave mountains. He placed the tip of the sword against the wall with great reluctance. The prize was worth the cost, but that didn't make the cost easy to pay. "You will be used for a great purpose," he said to the weapon. Then he activated the binding at full power, at least the full extent of power it could manage down here. The song of falling ash shone with fire, light, and destruction. Its bright light filled the hall, illuminating the stone, but failing to pierce through. The walls here had been invested with authority to make them inviolable, but this sword was the true product of a monarch, made in the Soul Forge and imbued with his will to break. And weakened though he may have been, Regan Shen was a monarch as well. "Begone!" Regan Shen commanded. The authority on the wall shattered, and then the wall did. A wave of flaming power dissolved the broad stone wall, leaving a hole big enough to pass a cloud fortress through. The blade of falling ash was twisted and half-melted, its physical shell now leaking madra. Regan Shen sheathed it anyway. He could repurpose its material, and the masterpiece of a monarch soulsmith deserved more than to be thrown away. Then again, this labyrinth might be the best place to dispose of such works. No one knew how many genius soulsmiths had put their life's work into this place. And nowhere was that more evident than in this room. Behind the wall, he found a massive chamber filled with blue crystals. But perhaps crystals was the wrong word. Though they seemed to be solid, they flowed like rivers over every inch of the walls and floor. This was madra forged naturally and infused with aura for years. This material would be perfect to make priceless treasures, but Regan Shen couldn't afford to open his void space more than necessary. He would risk destabilizing the rest of his collection. In the center of the chamber, several hundred yards from the entrance, was a shining sphere the size of Shen's entire torso. It looked like a perfectly round sapphire, and it emitted a thick beam of blue energy into the air. Inside that ball of blue, lightning crackled every few moments. When it did, corresponding sparks flickered through every river of crystal in the entire room. Regan Shen felt the envy grip him as he watched the sphere at the heart of the room. The storm core, the impossible treasure born from the weeping dragon's power. Just taking this for himself and leaving would solidify his status as one of the greatest monarchs in history. But, of course, he wasn't content with just being one of the greatest monarchs. And if he left this project half-finished, he would be forced out of this world in a matter of weeks. He had to be quick. For this exact purpose, Regan Shen had prepared a special container. He pulled a rectangular metal case off his belt and approached the core. The case was empty, having been designed solely to carry this item. Just like any other spatial artifact in this environment, it would decay quickly every time he used it here, but that was no problem. It was disposable. This container only had to open twice, once to put the core in, and once to take it out again. Then its purpose would be fulfilled. Regan Shen had his perception stretched out as he approached the storm core, but he felt no hostile presences among the overwhelming power of water and lightning. Not until a blue lightning bolt crashed down on him. Weakened as he was, the striker technique should have killed him instantly. Instead, a golden shell of earth and destruction mantra appeared over his head, taking the brunt of the attack. The shield was made to last and should have taken 10 to 15 such blows, but it shattered after only one. The ring that hosted that binding went dim on his finger. This place truly devoured treasures. The shield ring had bought him enough time to see his opponent, a huge storm cloud, crackling with sapphire lightning, with two limbs molded to resemble a pair of thick arms. A natural spirit, formed from the storm core's power, and no doubt guided by some script buried here to protect the room. The people who sealed this place off had never intended to return. Those ancient soulsmiths were more than capable of crafting living weapons that could do battle with monarchs, so if this thing could exert its full strength while Regan Shen was veiled, he would have been annihilated in a breath. But the suppression field was an even-handed curse. No one could escape it. Thus, the spirit was only on his own level, and no opponent of the same level could defeat the Lion Monarch. Drawing a pair of launcher constructs, one in each hand, Regan Shen began the battle. Far above the battle in the labyrinth, the Holy Wind School had begun to return to the slopes of the mountain they called the Great Father. When they felt the mountain begin to shake again, some panicked, thinking the wandering Titan had decided to return. Others dismissed it. They were only aftershocks. When the shaking died down in mere hours, this crowd felt themselves vindicated. The very next day, a copper child sent to fetch water said that Great Father's tears were lower than they should be. No one listened to her. 3 weeks later, when they discovered that the Dragon River was starting to dry up, they blamed the change on the Dread God's attack. The valley had been reshaped by that monster, and besides, at least they were better off than the Golden Sword School. Their mountain was still intact. So they continued their lives as the power in their water faded, day by day. The Sage of Red Faith was not the most precise when it came to spatial transportation under his own power. He preferred using a tool, and this was one more benefit of his cooperation with Regan Shen. The Lion had plenty of tools to spare. A gate key brought him back to the cloud fortress that was Red Moon Hall's mobile headquarters. The massive ship hovered over mountains somewhere in the western Ashwind continent. He couldn't be bothered to determine their location any further. He strode across the dark wood of the deck as emissaries and agents of Red Moon Hall saluted him, men and women in dark robes marked with a red moon. Most of them had their shadows wrapped around their weapons, and with a few here and there keeping their shadows in the form of a sacred beast or twisted monster. Red Faith didn't acknowledge those who saluted him, and they were wise enough to move out of his way. A young man with a shadow in the form of a bushy-tailed crystalline fox bowed with fists pressed together, and Red Faith could feel sincere gratitude. This was one of their most recent recruits, a young True Gold who had reached Underlord quickly thanks to Red Faith's tutelage and sponsorship of his shadow. Not long ago, Red Faith would have valued him highly, thinking of him as an investment in the research. Now, he was useless. They were all useless. Red Faith chewed on the knuckle of his thumb to calm himself down. They weren't useless. They still had utility. Anything could be used if it brought him closer to Yeren Aurelius. Lower-ranking agents ushered him down past the top few decks to the ballroom-sized audience hall where Red Faith's blood shadow held court, like a puppet pretending to be a king. The entrance to the audience hall was tall and wide enough to make one forget it was inside a ship, and the two agents on the doors hurried to open the towering double doors before Red Faith had to trouble himself. But he was in a hurry, so he simply ordered them to open. They swung inward, pulling away from the hands of the agents. The audience hall was cavernous, a waste of space meant to satisfy the arrogance of their sect's other leader. The Herald of Red Moon Hall had developed a disastrous ego that fully blinded himself to practicality. For instance, the Herald insisted on being referred to as Red Moon. How needlessly confusing. It made far more sense to adopt a title, as Red Faith himself had done. The Herald hunched on a throne at the end of the hall, an inverted mirror of the sage, scarlet where he was pale. While Red Faith had lost color in his skin and hair, his former blood shadow was all red, bright scarlet hair trailing down his back, pink skin and crimson eyes. The only spots of white on him were his gold signs, rivers of white trailing down from the corners of his eyes as though he wept milk. Red Faith's own gold signs, bright like trails of blood, made far more sense, and were certainly more useful for intimidating and disconcerting the masses for a psychological advantage. The Herald had dismissed several emissaries when he felt the sage coming, and those emissaries saluted with their red-covered weapons before they left the room. Red Faith barely saw them. He was fixed on his opposite, his failed clone.
"You're wasting your time on this farce," Red Faith demanded as the doors shut behind him. "That you remain here instead of hunting for Yeren Aurelius, as I have done, only proves that you do not deserve the independence you stole."
The Herald, Red Moon, cocked his head to one side.
"That you believe searching on your own is more efficient than leveraging an organization establishes to me that you should have ceded to me in our union. The body should always be subordinate to the mind." "I am the mind, you are the body."
Red Faith wanted to scratch his own eyes out.
"The sage advances through understanding, and the Herald through brute force." "Such shallow understanding for one who calls himself a sage. You were born flesh and bone, while I was born from the spirit. My origin is that of the mind and the soul, and if I were allowed to lead our union, it would be Rigon Shen who begged our support, rather than the reverse."
Red Faith bit into the skin of his hand, letting the taste of blood and the flow of aura calm him.
"Let us at least agree that the perfect fusion is our highest priority. She is living proof of the validity of our research. Your opinion of me cannot be so low that you think I would abandon our ambition."
It was his ambition, which the former remnant Red Moon had only stolen, but Red Faith didn't quibble over semantics.
"Good. Then since you have such faith in the hall, tell me what you have learned."
Red Moon stared at him and began chewing on a fingernail. Red Faith left him to think. After a long pause, the Herald finally spoke.
"She is not hard to locate with spiritual perception, so we found her weeks ago, but I instructed my emissaries not to approach."
Red Faith's jaw slowly dropped. He wasn't sure which would win in the confrontation between his astonishment and his rage.
"I knew it," he whispered. "You sabotage our efforts."
Red Moon spat a bit of fingernail onto the floor.
"If you believe you are the mind in our relationship, then it should not trouble you so much to think. What will Yaren Aurelius do if we approach, or anyone approaches her on our behalf?
She would inevitably not cooperate, and with the Moonlight Bridge, it would be difficult to find her once she fled, especially for the Herald, who could not follow through space as Red Faith could. Though, granted, it would be complex to track her even for him.
You would let shadows of possibility stop you from attempting to attain ultimate power. We could kidnap Lyndon Aurelius or Aethon Aurelius and hold them hostage in exchange for her cooperation. I suppose that is what you would do, short-sighted as you are.
Red Faith's entire frustration came from the fact that he couldn't simply threaten a hostage and force Yaren to obey. He needed her to work with him willingly. It would be too easy for her to deceive or harm him otherwise, unless she was positively wrapped in soul oaths. Even that was not a viable option. He intended to fuel her advancement as part of his experiments. Who would freely sharpen a weapon that could turn on its user's throat?
That you think my view is so narrow only proves that your own vision is lacking,
Red Faith said.
She is one who hated her blood shadow, hated us, hated the Phoenix, but who carefully cultivated a clone shadow because she recognized its potential for power. She will be persuaded by the promise of more, but only if we find her and make that promise.
Identical scowls clashed as Sage and Harold glared at one another from opposite sides of the hall. Both of them calmed down and thought for a moment of silence. Red Faith thought about the situation. He considered Yaren's perspective and how he thought they should act. He considered what Red Moon would say to that and examined his arguments. He presented some of his own, all in his head. Across the hall, his clone did the same. When they were both finished, Red Moon spoke.
She will return to the valley when we begin. So we will follow Shen's instructions,
Red Faith agreed.
For now.
Unwittingly, the Monarch had positioned them exactly where they needed to be, for they were instructed to return south, soon, to Sacred Valley, where they would inevitably find Yaren Aurelius. Red Faith nodded.
We will have leverage on her then. She will join us with gratitude, and it will be in her own best interests to support the research. Very well. We will wait. As I said all along.
Red Faith snorted, but allowed the Herald his hollow victory. At least they were unified now, as they should have been all along. Chapter 7. It was Cassius's habit to stroll the streets of the city every night after dinner. It was a pleasant way to cycle, helping him to get a sense for the city, and reassured his employees, who often started their work when the sun went down, that he was around and watching. And, of course, Aethon had done this back when he was in charge. He had very often shirked his normal responsibilities, but whenever he had been in the city, he had walked its length and breadth. He intervened in problems, no matter how minor, and made sure the Aurelius presence was felt. Cassius didn't have Aethon's talent in using their bloodline legacy, but he was still an Aurelius. He saw more than anyone else could. So he stepped aside gracefully as Aethon plummeted from a rooftop above him. The Archlord landed gently, as though he'd merely stepped off a stoop, but he still clicked his tongue in disappointment.
"Were you trying to land on me?" Cassius asked.
"I was going to land on your shoulders, then I was going to make a joke about how it was your turn to hold me up, but now it's dead."
"That doesn't sound like a very good joke."
"Well, a moment's gone, isn't it? You ruined it."
Despite his words, the smile on Aethon's face looked more genuine than usual. He took a deep breath of the cool night air as he spread sapphire sleeves wide.
"You ever have a night when you're just glad you don't have to fight to the death?" Aethon asked.
"Yes, every night."
"Every night? Really? What do you do if you're not fighting for your life?"
"Literally anything else."
"Huh. Well, sometimes even I prefer not to have the pressure of the world on my shoulders."
Aethon looked at Cassius's shoulders and sighed in regret, no doubt thinking of the missed opportunity for his joke. Cassius glimpsed something in the strands of power constantly radiated by his bloodline, and looked off to his left. Two streets over, someone was creeping along an alleyway outside a restaurant. A quick scan showed that their spirit was veiled. A robber? They were walking away from the restaurant, but there were houses that way. Cassius was about to leap over the house and confront the sneaking man when Ethan manifested a ball of mudra between his fingers, a tiny striker technique. He closed one eye, aimed for a moment, and then hurled it into the sky. It came down on the same man Cassius had been watching, driving into the man's spirit and tearing through his veil. He yelped. An employee of the restaurant came out furious while wiping hands on her apron.
"Thief?"
Cassius asked.
"He dined without paying."
Ethan shook his fist at the sky in mock outrage.
"Not in my town."
Then he strode down the street, whistling. They didn't foil any more crimes that night, though Ethan shouted encouragement to a girl trying to work up the courage to dance, then led Cassius up to a bird's nest on top of a chimney. Cassius had expected them to be dread beasts or hostile sacred crows or something, but no, Ethan just wanted to show him some sparkly eggshells. Ethan then climbed to the top of the highest tower around, if you could call soaring from floor to floor with one tap of the foot climbing, and trusted Cassius to follow. With a lot of grumbling and much more physical exertion, Cassius eventually made it up. He found Ethan sitting on the edge of the roof, staring out into the night. Usually his hair would be blowing in the breeze, and Cassius was glad he'd seen sense and kept it short. Long hair could be a liability in combat. Although Cassius reflected on that as he sat down by Ethan. That was true in combat between golds, but Ethan was an archlord now. How could an opponent getting a grip on his hair possibly inconvenience him? And he couldn't be blinded by it fluttering into his eyes.
"What a beautiful city," Ethan sighed.
"Then again, I found that most cities are beautiful if you have the right perspective."
Cassius shook himself back to reality. He had just gotten distracted thinking about hair. Ethan would be proud.
"I don't often find you in a contemplative mood," Cassius said.
These days, he mostly didn't find Ethan at all. The Archlord was in high demand.
"I contemplate all the time. Truly, my deep machinations make monarchs and emperors tremble."
He waited a beat, then added,
"I am shocked that man on the third floor can eat so much fried meat at once. Truly shocked. It's not his eye and body or anything. I think he's just very hungry."
Cassius wasn't paying attention to the man on the third floor of the tower, as he was studying Ethan. The Archlord had leaned back on his palms, his feet still dangling off the edge, and was now staring up at the stars with a small, content smile.
"You look happy," Cassius observed.
Ethan responded without looking away from the sky.
"I'm always happy. Haven't you noticed how much I smile?"
"Then you're doing well."
"My new haircut suits me, so I suppose I'm doing wonderfully."
Cassius nodded and leaned back himself, looking up at the stars. Ethan would answer seriously soon, or he never would. After a minute or so of silence, Ethan spoke.
"Sincerely, I am content. Better than I have been in a long time."
Cassius thought back to the beaten, battered, and burned underlord that had come through the Aurelius family portal about 9 years ago. Since then, as long as Cassius had known him, he had been searching for something.
"I'm glad you found what you were looking for," Cassius said.
Ethan seemed to know what he meant, because he nodded.
"Everything's finally—"
With a slap to his own mouth, Ethan cut himself off. The slap made such a loud explosion that Cassius shot up, cycling his mudra against an attack. Ethan gave a heavy breath of relief.
"I almost said everything's finally perfect. Can you imagine what a mistake that would have been? I can't afford to tempt fate like that."
Cassius was happy for him. He really was. But he still kicked Ethan off the tower. It felt just as good as the Emperor had promised. Regan Shen coughed up blood, which wasn't as bad a sign as it seemed. 9 flying tridents wove around him, each glowing with the soft green flame of Death Mudra. He directed the Nightstone Sphere formation according to a method passed down for generations on the Iceflower continent. They swept through in a complex pattern, butchering the army of blood spirits that filled this massive chamber. He had to fuel their flight by scattering his own natural treasures, given the lack of wind aura here, but their performance was worth it. The Blood Core's prison looked identical to the one that had held the Storm Core, except instead of being covered in flowing blue crystals, this one was filled with semi-liquid beings that hungered to consume flesh. The second Regan Shen had blasted his way in here, he'd been flooded by a tide of blood spirits. The rich blood aura was too much for his weakened body, especially combined with the half-formed ruler techniques of this host. Blood oozed from his eyes, from the smallest of scratches, and pooled in his chest. Perhaps a human would have died, Regan Shen didn't know. He wore his human form like a cloak. And lions were not so fragile. He maintained his concentration, focusing his will on the 9 tridents as they wove a complex web of green death throughout the room. In seconds, there was silence, except for the red liquid spattering to the stone floor. The pressure on Shen's veins eased up, and he wiped off his lips with the back of one hand. The blood core sent a crimson pillar of light up to the ceiling. If not for the suppression field, its power would have blasted through the entire mountain and pierced the sky. Then again, if it weren't for the suppression field, the blood core would have no reason to be here. Shen readied the second of the 4 silver containers he had prepared. He'd chosen the order of this operation very carefully. If he had removed the Titan core to the west, the golden beam currently streaming into the sky would have been interrupted. Everyone in 100 miles would notice. Likewise with the east. When he removed the silent core from beneath Mount Samara, its ring would begin to fade within a day. He had spent almost a year living here, in his own personal netherworld of private torment, taking his time at every turn. He had mapped and cleared the routes between all 4 peaks, disabled countless scripts, and even tampered with the great script circle that maintained the suppression field. All to allow this. When the locals noticed, it would only be a matter of time before the other monarchs did as well. This was the last step he could perform slowly. Soon, the race would begin. Regan Shen seized the blood core, as large around as his own midsection, and shoved it toward the opening of a silver rectangular case small enough to fit in one hand. Space distorted as the core was slurped inside, like water draining. He could rest now, catch his breath, take his time. Only when the next step began would he have to rush. For now, he simply had to take the blood core to the south and return it to where it had always belonged. Lyndon strode through the school building that the city had given him, watching the rows of students wearing burnt orange and pale blue. There were about 40 of them, all younger than Lyndon himself, most copper or iron. They had gone through the training to cleanse their madra, returning it to a pure state. If they had been too advanced, it wouldn't have worked. Now they had their eyes closed, cycling clumsily according to a spiritual enforcer technique that Lyndon had taught them. The heart of twin stars. Lyndon had to point out mistakes here and there, but for the most part, their madra control was more than good enough for the technique, and they weren't splitting their cores today. This was only a cycling technique to prepare them. Under Lyndon's supervision, they should have an easier time than he himself had, but his stomach rolled as he sensed them. What if he was wrong? What if they messed up under his guidance and damaged their own spirits? What if he hadn't eased the way for them as much as he thought, and the spiritual pain was too much for them? It was gut-churning being responsible for someone else advancing safely. He preferred when it was only his own safety he risked. Little Blue patted the back of his ear and quietly whispered encouragement to him. It did help. He was confident in his theoretical understanding, though he would be more confident if Dross were still around. Lyndon flexed his right arm. He had stitched it together with hunger madra he'd gathered from Dreadbeast cores, though the limb was barely functional. It looked like it was covered in painted-over cracks, which from a soulsmithing perspective was roughly what he'd done. He could use the consume technique again, and he did, but he was careful every time. With a less functional arm and no dross, the burden on the Heart of Twin Stars technique was increased. He had to take much longer to sort the various powers he absorbed. Therefore, Lyndon's comprehension of Heart of Twin Stars was higher than it had ever been. He should be completely confident in teaching it to others. There was only one person Lyndon knew of who might understand the principles of pure Madra better than he did. As if summoned by Lyndon's thoughts, Ethan swooped in through the window at that exact moment. He straightened his pink and yellow clothes once he landed, then smoothed back his hair, which was all reassuringly normal behavior. But he stared off into the distance with a distracted frown on his face. The students all bubbled at his entrance, their cycling forgotten. Some called questions, while others whispered his name. For his part, Lyndon swept his spiritual perception over the students again, suddenly frightened that Ethan had sensed a problem or cycling deviation that he'd missed. But while he panicked internally, he kept himself under control outwardly so he wouldn't disturb the students. Strong emotion could disrupt the Heart of Twin Stars.
"How can I help you, Archlord?" Lyndon asked.
"Did you sense anything just now?"
Lyndon followed Ethan's gaze. The Aurelius was staring through the western wall. Why was Ethan coming to him? Surely, if there was anything he could sense, Ethan would already have seen it, and if it were a matter of spiritual perception, Yeren's could extend the furthest among all of them.
So it must be...
Lyndon aligned himself to the void icon. It had become easier this year, though it was still strange. While he touched the icon, he felt everything around him as vessels that could be drained, material that could be consumed. But he sensed no authority challenging his own.
"Nothing," Lyndon said, though he didn't release the icon.
Ethan tapped his own lip.
"I'm not sure I did either.
It's nothing, I'm sure. Almost sure."
That didn't give Lyndon much information, but he tried to stretch his perception even farther. They were hundreds of miles from Sacred Valley now, but that was the direction Ethan was looking, so he reached. He passed through an uncountable sea of powers, Madra and aura of every aspect, and here and there a will that might have been strong enough to affect something. An ordinary population, in other words.
"What am I looking for?"
"I don't know."
Ethan gave Lyndon a brief, embarrassed shrug.
"Perhaps it has been too long since I've lived without a crisis. I shouldn't have disturbed you."
But his frown deepened, and Lyndon's forehead broke out into a cold sweat. Ethan was being both serious and uncertain.
"Students, I need to have a word with the Archlord. Cycle with your parasite rings for an hour tonight, but don't activate the Heart of Twin Stars. Wait for my supervision, all right?"
They murmured their agreement, but most of the students weren't in a hurry to leave. They filtered out with many a glance backward. Some hid beneath the windows, hoping to hear something. Lyndon even felt some spiritual senses brushing up against the building. Some students must have gotten their parents or older siblings involved, and quickly, they'd only left seconds ago. But there was nothing for them to sense yet.
"So you had a premonition?" Lyndon asked, keeping his voice low.
"A bad feeling. Intuition."
Ethan tapped his chin, still staring to the west.
"It's like all the aura in the world suddenly shifted, like a loose tile. But when I looked closer, everything was as it should be."
"Sacred Valley?" Lyndon asked.
"I hope not. I'm not in a hurry to return."
Lyndon appreciated Ethan's implication that he would immediately rush toward the source of trouble. If Ethan was this serious, then Lyndon couldn't brush this off as a feeling. He sat down in a cycling position, where a student had sat only a moment before, and cycled his pure Madra. He opened up his perception as broadly as he could. All the while, he stretched out to the void icon. Emptiness, hunger, and non-existence. He didn't sense anything that alarmed him, but he didn't give up right away. Better to be safe. Regan Shen stood beneath the Great Father once more, at the heart of the chamber filled with oozing blue crystals. He had gone through great battles, suffered indignities, and lost weapons of incalculable value these last few days. But now, there were no obstacles remaining. He raised the silver container at his belt, the one that had been stained red. The blood core was overpowering its case. Fortunately, he didn't need it anymore. Regan Shen steadied himself, cycling his madra, stilling his heart and focusing his will. This was it. When he placed the blood core back where it had belonged, he would be flipping the hourglass. Then the whole world would be against him. For a time. When his mind was steady, Shen summoned the blood core. The huge red sphere streamed out of the tiny flask, and he placed it on the altar from which he had first taken the storm core. Instantly, red light poured upward, and the room changed. The liquid-looking crystals all over the walls and ceiling turned from blue to purple in an instant, blood mudra flowing through them. The lightning now crackled red. Originally, this chamber had been made to hold the blood core. The cores had been scrambled long ago, their placements swapped, to help change the function of the script they powered. In a sense, Regan Shen was setting something right. The power of storms had built up in this room over centuries of exposure to the storm core, leaving these remainders, but that would be cleared out soon. Now, for the first time in memory, this place would serve its true purpose. Shen didn't linger. He dashed out of the room, pitting his willpower against reality to push him faster, faster than his body could normally handle. Even the air swept around him, guided by his soulfire control. Hunger Madra focused on him. He was spending too much power in the labyrinth, but he had no choice. The clock had begun to tick. One of the elders of the Holy Wind School dipped her hand into Great Father's tears to take a drink. The water level had fallen after the attack of the Titan, but over the last few days it had risen again. But it was no longer as crystal clear as before. An instant after tasting the water, she spat it out. The Great Father's tears had been corrupted. This coppery tang was unmistakable. It was blood. She drew herself up, shouting in fury for the guards. If their most sacred place had been defiled with violence, then her entire school had failed in its duty. There might even be a body at the bottom of the spring. She marched away, furious, as bit by bit, the water darkened further. The door slamming open interrupted Linden's meal, though both he and Yeren had sensed Athan coming from a mile away. They both looked to him in equal irritation. They had specifically taken time away from training and anyone else but each other and booked an entire restaurant. Linden had even gone to see a barber on Athan's desperate pleading. Yeren's sword arms stretched out, but she deliberately pulled them back in.
"You had a chance to keep your skin in one piece, and you left it at home. It happened again."
Linden exchanged a look with Yeren. It had been weeks since Athan had felt his first premonition of danger, and both had kept their eyes out, but neither had sensed anything like what Athan had described. They still took it seriously. Yeren frowned, and her perception rushed out of the restaurant in a river. She might have a chance of reaching all the way to Sacred Valley, if that was indeed where the problem had come from, but she still wouldn't be able to push past the suppression field. Linden reached out to the void icon. He still spoke as he did.
"This is bad timing, Athan."
"It could have been worse," Athan pointed out. "Believe it or not, I do know when people can be interrupted and when they can't."
Linden's cheeks heated, and he focused on his spiritual sense to avoid meeting Athan's eye. Again, he felt no foreign authority in the area. There was no influence that reminded him of the void icon, nor any powerful wills working against them. Yeren's ruby eyes snapped open.
"Not a sniff or a hair. I'd be red hot if I thought you were just poking at us, Athan. But I don't think you are. You've got me shaking."
Linden had a similar feeling. The longer this went without passing as one of Athan's jokes, the more disturbed he became. Athan scratched furiously at the side of his head, disturbing his short hair.
"It's something, but if only I could... maybe if I fly."
He mumbled to himself as he left, leaving Linden and Yeren staring at the door in shock.
"He didn't even try to pull up a chair," Linden said.
Yeren leaned over to look out the window. She didn't watch the street, looking instead to the sky.
"What are you looking for?"
"Just checking to be sure the moon's still there.
The longer he does this, the bigger the problem's gonna be.
She fell back into her chair and speared a chunk of eel. She looked at it, then replaced it without eating it.
Maybe we should take a cloud ship out west, Lyndon suggested. I do think he sensed something.
That's why I'm shaking.
The shattered remains of Mount Venture still vomited up yellow light. It was fainter than it had been, the core having been fed upon by the Titan, but it would work for Shen's purposes. There was no guardian spirit in this chamber, which was filled with jagged blades of golden stone. Most likely one had formed here, but the wandering Titan had annihilated it without even noticing. Another palm-sized silver flask came off his belt, and he absorbed the Titan core. The yellow light vanished. It had been flickering off and on since the Dread God had consumed most of its power, so Shen could only hope this would go unnoticed for a while. He pushed himself. Faster! Lyndon found Aethon standing on the edge of Windfall's cloud base, looking west.
Strange feeling? Lyndon asked.
Aethon's clothes were rumpled, and he had worn the same thing for 3 days straight. Given that Aethon normally changed at least twice a day, Lyndon thought he might be on the verge of death.
Every time I turn around, Aethon responded. If I didn't know better, I would say it was just nerves, anxiety, overactive imagination.
So what is it? Aethon threw out his hands in frustration.
You think I know, and I'm holding out on you.
Apologies if I'm overstepping, but what would Tiberian Aurelius's advisor say? Aethon closed his mouth. He brought his arms around and crossed them, thinking. To Lyndon's discomfort, he found traces of someone he didn't recognize in Aethon's expression. Just flickers, like the shadow of another person passing through the man.
There are three possibilities,
Aethon responded eventually, and all playfulness was gone from his tone.
One, there is a problem with me, a working of will or authority that I cannot detect, which is compromising my senses. Two, I could be sensing authority at work. If I'm close to Sage, especially the Oracle icon, which I was once considered a prime candidate to manifest, then I could be picking up hints of another Sage or Monarch's working. It could be a working you are too inexperienced to recognize, or something too far away from the realm of the Void icon.
Lyndon didn't take offense at the slight to his abilities. It was a reasonable possibility. He only listened.
Three.
The businesslike Aethon hesitated, and Lyndon saw the usual man again, although an uncertain one.
You're going to laugh.
I usually don't.
That's true. It's of great concern to me. The third possibility is fate.
Lyndon didn't feel like laughing. In fact, he sought out the warmth of Suriel's marble for comfort. She had spoken of fate, reading it, changing it, altering its flow.
Fate, or destiny, or the will of the heavens, it's a real force. Dream artists contact it once in a while, and some monarchs are more attuned to it than others. As an archlord with no dream abilities, I should have no ability to see it. So that's a distant third possibility.
Lyndon didn't think it sounded distant. If he were to bet, based on this conversation, he would put his chips on fate.
But that would be a bet he'd be happy to lose.
Pardon, but I hope the problem is with you, Lyndon said.
I would be delighted.
When Rhaegon Shen placed the Titan core in the north, where it belonged, the mountain the locals called Yoma erupted in stone spires. Even irons wouldn't miss a sign like that. Shen flew down the holes of the labyrinth's upper layer, supported by blue strands of energy emanating from a construct at his belt. The construct wouldn't last long, but this was the fastest and most economical way of traveling for now. Subject One's attacks had intensified, and now there were traps of hunger mud replaced in his way, forger techniques strung across the halls like webs. If he had been less skilled, he might have fallen for them, but they still slowed him down. As soon as the pillar of light from the western peak had vanished, he'd put himself on a time limit, and it would only run out faster and faster. He reached the eastern chamber, buried beneath Mount Samara, and detonated another powerful weapon to carve through the wall. This chamber had been influenced by the Silent Core for hundreds of years, so it should be a trap of powerful light and dream mudra. He could sense that it was, but he couldn't see anything. Beyond the hole in the wall, he saw only a chaotic jumble of spinning images. Even his aura sight was useless here, though that had more to do with the suppression field than the complexity of this dream working. Shen placed a pair of spectacles over his eyes, which should show him the path through this dream formation. Unfortunately, he saw immediately that this wasn't a formation, so much as a mess. There was no path through. The strong and weak points of the illusion shifted with every second. So he had no choice. Regan focused his willpower again, hating how long it took him, and how weak his authority felt here.
"Flee!" the monarch commanded.
The fog of deceptive mudra and aura parted like a forking river. He dashed through, scooping up the purple-white silent core now that he could see it clearly. He had to be quick. There were undoubtedly spirits that had formed inside this environment as well. He placed the storm core on its altar, then ran away as the clouds of dream mudra began to flash with lightning. From this moment, the ring of the mountain ahead would start to change. This was his last step, and then he could proceed into the true depths of the labyrinth. Regan Shen flooded his mudra through his flight construct, shattering it almost immediately. Three of the four cores had been returned to their proper places. Once he placed the silent core in the chamber, all of Sacred Valley would change. Now, the world would change. The messenger constructs finally returned to Linden. Most were shaped like butterflies of various colors, though some resembled birds, clouds of sparks, or mechanical flying machines. Some of the faster ones had returned already, but he'd sent them out at roughly the same time, so he expected them to arrive more or less at once. He listened to each message. Some constructs bore recorded messages from human scouts. Others pinged yes or no to tell him they'd seen what he'd sent them to look for, and still others gave their own rudimentary opinion, like a remnant's. When they finished, Linden summarized the information and brought it to Aethon. He found the Archlord waiting right outside of Linden's house on Windfall.
"You could have deactivated the ward against me," Aethon pointed out. "Then I would already know what you have to say."
"Apologies, it slipped my mind."
That was a lie that fooled no one. Linden didn't want to set a precedent of allowing Aethon to spy on his home.
"There's so much activity in and around Sacred Valley, it's hard to pinpoint anything. There's a new entrance into the labyrinth. Some strange remnants have popped up with aspects no one can recognize. The orris trees on Mount Yoma have started to wither. A tribe of outsiders from the south came into the valley to conquer, but left as soon as the suppression field set in."
Linden spread his hands. If he had to rely on notes, he would have waved them in the air.
"I don't know what to look for. There's too much."
Aethon frowned into the distance.
"Keep going. Dread beasts are gathering outside the valley. Some people say Samara's ring is dimmer or its light is less consistent. Almost certainly damage from the—"
Aethon cut him off without a word. His entire aspect had become cold.
"The ring around the mountain to the east. Did they report a change in color? Sparks?"
"Sparks, yes. One report said the light crackled now. But color, I don't know. We'll be able to see for ourselves tomorrow, though."
Windfall had been heading back to Sacred Valley for several days now. Aethon's premonition was too disturbing to ignore, but he still wasn't certain it had anything to do with Sacred Valley, or they both would have rushed over. Aethon extended a hand over the edge of the cloud fortress, and a golden light shimmered. The bounding gazelle, his high-speed cloud ship, materialized from sparks of gold over the edge.
"We need to see for ourselves. Send a message to Yeren, just in case."
Linden did, launching a purple and white butterfly after Yeren's spiritual signature. The technique dispersed into the aura, where it would make the journey to Serpent's Grave in hours instead of days. Thanks to her moonlight bridge, Yeren could meet them anywhere at any time. She had stayed back in Serpent's Grave to train a new batch of students and keep Mercy company, who was in between jobs for her family at the moment. Linden joined Aethon aboard the cloud ship as it shot off, leaving the lumbering Windfall behind. He was feeling left behind himself.
Ethan, what would it mean if Samara's ring changed color?
The suppression field needs a power source,
Ethan said, still icy.
The ring around the mountain should be a side effect of housing such a source.
He was looking westward, as though heading to meet a blood enemy. Lyndon picked up on the implication. If it was changing color, that meant the aspects of the power had changed. But the only thing he could think of that might cause that was the Titan's attack.
I would find it more alarming if the ring really was fading, Lyndon said.
A loss of power to the suppression field might call the Dread God back, or all of them this time. Ethan glanced at him, but Lyndon followed the train of logic before the Archlord said a word.
Unless the power source was altered.
He spun out the scenario in his mind.
If it just ran out of power, we could replace it. But if it changed, that means someone else has already done that. So someone could be messing with the labyrinth from the inside.
Ethan didn't respond, but he flooded the propulsion constructs with Madra. So much pure Madra would make the ship run faster now, but it would dilute the network of constructs that ran it, so the cloud ship would require extensive maintenance and repair later. Lyndon didn't comment. They did indeed need to move faster. They flew through the night, covering in hours what should have taken them days, if not weeks, in a slower vessel. Ethan began reporting before the valley was visible to Lyndon.
Clear distortion in the ring, but I don't see much change in color. I suspect it may not be as bright as it was. I don't see the pillar of Earth Madra to the west.
It's been unsteady since the Titan fed on it, Lyndon reported. It isn't unusual for it to vanish for days at a time.
Ethan nodded, but he remained silent, watching as they blasted through the skies. Only when Lyndon could see Samara's ring with his own eyes did Ethan let out a breath of relief. His normal self leaked back into him.
I'm not ashamed to admit that I was frightened for a while there. It seems I may have thought too much.
Better too much than too little. But if you'll pardon me for saying so, you were frightening in your own right.
Ethan flinched.
I have heard that before. I do apologize. Take it as my reaction to...
It trailed off. The pillar of light on the western end of Sacred Valley had returned, but now it wasn't golden yellow. Now it was a soft white, a color that reminded him of Samara's ring, in fact. That was strange, but sometimes certain aspects of Madra changed color as they lost power. Still, it was better to be safe, in case someone was tinkering with the structure of Sacred Valley. Lyndon extended his perception and opened himself to the void icon, reaching out to the valley. He wouldn't be able to feel anything past the border, but he could still get a sense of the surrounding aura, which, he realized, was changing before his eyes. The chaotic powers of vital aura spun like a churning sea. He traced the sensation back, expecting his senses to weaken as they approached Sacred Valley. But they didn't.
Lyndon, stop!
Ethan shouted. Ethan grabbed Lyndon's shoulder and his Madra flooded into Lyndon's spirit, but they were both too late. A wave of power gushed out of Sacred Valley, rushing out in all directions, sweeping over their cloud ship in an instant. A pure white aura that felt to Lyndon's senses like an endless, gnawing greed for more. Hunger aura. Power blotted out Lyndon's senses, and he was swallowed by blinding pain. Chapter 8 Akura Malas had submerged herself in a world of silhouettes, her world of night technique. Shadows and dreams moved around her, vague shapes she could make out only distantly. But they came with impressions. As she saw the outline of a woman with a staff, she wouldn't necessarily be able to identify it with her eyes, but her spirit felt Emrys Silentborn. The Remnant Queen would be involved in her future soon. Close by, drifting in the emptiness, she found the shadows of a ruined city. There would be a battle here, but she felt as though the battle hadn't included her, so she would travel to this place in the aftermath of someone else's battle. These hints and clues were difficult to piece together, but the world of night was the best technique Malas had to interact with fate. In these recent years, the future had been even more obscured than usual. She had seen no hint of the bleeding phoenix rising, for instance,
and usually the dread gods were as difficult to spot as sharks crammed into a bathtub. But this made twice within half a decade that she had failed to spot one. Someone was meddling with her perception, or with the flow of the future. Fate, as she understood it, was only a tendency for things to happen a certain way, just as you could stop an object from falling by catching it, so you could take action to prevent certain outcomes. Most of the time. Malice scanned these suggestions of the future, trying to piece them together, and realized she couldn't. Some events seemed even to contradict one another. Something strange was going on. She had immersed herself into this world several times over the last few months, spending every ounce of her attention to try to unravel the future. She couldn't allow herself to be caught unawares again. Moments after thinking that, she was caught unaware. Four shadows suddenly loomed up in her world of night, surrounding her, like black statues that had sprouted from the ground. A bird, a shelled warrior, a tiger with a halo, and a dragon accompanied by clouds. She didn't need her spiritual sense to recognize the dread gods. They lurked in the distance forever, threats that always existed somewhere in the world, but now they were here, right now, looking down on her. And with every passing second, they grew larger. Malice tore the technique apart and stepped back into the real world.
"Dread gods," she called,
and while terror coursed through her soul, her voice was that of a majestic queen. Carried by her will, those words echoed throughout Moongrave. Everyone heard, as though she stood before them, and the entire city rushed into action. They did not panic. They had prepared for this. Shelters were opened, powerful sacred artists were awakened, emergency constructs were wheeled out of treasuries, and messages flew all throughout her territory. Malice herself reached out to Charity, who had contacted her at almost the same time. Her granddaughter's voice rang in her mind.
"It's the Northwest, Grandmother. Mercy's still there."
"Then bring her back," Malice ordered, "and move our people into position."
Lyndon sat up with his head and spirit screaming. He had been brought to the second floor of his house on Windfall and lain on the couch. He had never entirely lost consciousness, but he didn't remember much, just the blinding sight of so much hunger washing over the land in a wave. If he hadn't been open to the void icon at the time, it wouldn't have been so bad, but he had his aura sight and his perception and his sage senses open wide. Even now he was finding it hard to focus his vision. He kept sliding between seeing double, seeing blurs, and seeing only the colored wash of aura. A fuzzy mass of red that Lyndon was sure was Yeren broke off from talking, appearing at his side in a blink.
"Whoa, steady there. Don't rock the boat. Can you drink?"
A cup was lifted to his lips, and Lyndon took a sip of water. Something waved in front of his face.
"Still got your eyes. How many arms do I have?"
Lyndon peered at her.
"8.
She chuckled, and so did Ethan, who was apparently still in the room. They must have thought he was making a joke about her sword arms, but he really saw 4 of her, each with a pair of hazy human arms.
"You'll be fine after some rest," Ethan assured him. "You were looking right at the field when it dropped."
That spiked Lyndon's alarm.
"The suppression field. The dread gods."
He started to move, but Yeren had him by the shoulders. Ethan made a sound of reassurance.